71. A man walks into a bar, Zig called out, easing the front door open. Decades ago, Zig's father would make the same joke when 10-year-old Zig would enter their local pub, on his regular quest to get your father's ass back here. As a kid, Zig laughed along with his dad's joke, even though he didn't quite get it. When he got older, he saw it for what it was. A great way to disarm, especially when trouble was coming. Mr. King? Elijah? Roddy added, beer whiff rolling over them. But also another smell, a faint sour and sweet one that Zig couldn't quite place. As Zig followed Roddy inside, he noticed that Roddy's hand wasn't on his gun. When a uniformed cop enters a bar, people look away and shut down. Roddy clearly wanted answers. No trouble. Inside, the bar itself was a gorgeous rustic counter, the front of it made from brushed corrugated metal, like you find on posh farmhouses that no longer have real farms and that people rent for fancy weddings. A dozen industrial stools sat in front of it, purposefully mismatched in bronze, white, and gunmetal. But the real stars of the show were the taps. At least 20 of them, lined up one next to the other along the right-hand wall, like a self-serve yogurt place, but for craft beers with names like Liberty Ale, Hail to the Hop Thief, and Am I Right? You see him? Zig asked, glancing around. A dozen customers, all young, a mix of black and white, some with an educated polish, some looking more working class, were scattered throughout, drinking and eating jalapeno poppers and nachos. You're just a cop, a man called out. The door to the kitchen swung wide, revealing a bald African-American man with thick caterpillar eyebrows. Slightly younger than Zig, though he looked older than he did in the painting. Strolling behind the bar, he never took his eyes off Roddy's police uniform. Behind him, on the back wall, was a framed dollar where someone had written, "This was in a stripper's thong. Go, Elijah," in thick black magic marker. You said you were a fed, Elijah added, calm as could be. He had an ease about him, pouring himself a glass of water, which he sipped like a scotch. I said I was investigating, Roddy countered. Two of the higher polished customers, both with bougie beards, already getting up to leave. He's also Nola Brown's brother, Zig added. There was a pause. We're trying to keep her alive, Zig explained. You as well. We know what happened to Colonel Mint and Rashida Robinson. Elijah studied Roddy's face. You got her eyes all right, he said. Now let me guess. You want to chat about Grandma's pantry? 72. Nola spent the next hour around back in the skate park. From her angle, on a bench that was spray-painted with a Puerto Rican flag, she pretended to flip through a newspaper, her eyes never leaving the small Card Kingdom parking lot. Three cars in total. Old light blue Kia, even older Honda Civic, and the one Nola was watching, a sleek black Audi A8, freshly waxed, $100,000 car. Find the driver, and she'd find who'd paid for the elevator. According to the sign in the front window, Card Kingdom closed at 5 p.m. Half hour to go. Just had to wait. Sure enough, at 5:02, the back door swung open. Beanie Hat strolled out, lit a cigarette, and drove off in his old Civic, where a decal in the back window read, "The Empire doesn't care about your stick figure family," as Darth Vader sliced apart a bunch of stick figures. 20 minutes later, the back door opened again. This time it was an older woman, Asian, mid-50s, angry gait, who plowed toward the light blue Kia. As she pulled out of the lot, an old AC/DC song faded behind her. Even before the Kia was out of sight, Nola jumped from her seat, quickly hopping the chain-link fence that separated the skate park from the parking lot. From her back pocket, she pulled out a small leather case that held colored pencils, an X-Acto knife, and a few metal tools that looked like dental instruments, a torsion wrench and short hook among them. Lockpick kit. With a careful push, she shoved the pick into the door's keyhole. same cheap lock as the front door, was smarter than it looked. In neighborhoods like this, expensive locks make people take notice. For a moment, she jiggered the tools. Click. Glancing over her shoulder one last time, Nola tugged the door open and slipped inside. The card store was dark, lit by a faint red glow from a section of lava lamps. On her right was a bookshelf filled with half a dozen picture frames, all with the same stock photo. A graduation shot of a girl in cap and gown, her mom, dad, and brother embracing her in a group hug, like it was the greatest day of their lives. For a few seconds, she spied the room, moving left to right, dividing it into more scannable sections. Military training told her that the last place you ever want to be is on an elevator. Tactically, it's like being on a submarine. Plus, around the store, there were no cameras. She shook her head, knowing better. When things are this easy, it's always a trap. Whatever they were hiding upstairs, they didn't want any record of it. But it wasn't like she had a choice. Nola continued looking around. If there were stairs, she couldn't find them. Hesitantly, she headed for the elevator, spotting a keypad above the call buttons. Crap. She'd need a code. Yet before she could even hit the call button, to her surprise, it lit up. There was a sound, a metal hiccup. The elevator doors slid open, revealing a bearded man with pale white skin and crooked teeth the color of margarine.
"Yeah, I see her," he said with a thick Philly accent into a high-tech walkie-talkie. He was big, with a trendy tribal font tattoo that read Big Sleeps across his forearm. Nola planted her feet. He had a stupidly oversized luxury watch on his right wrist and leaned forward as he moved, left-handed, and used to being on the offensive.
"Come on, girl," he warned, stepping toward Nola. "You really think we wouldn't see you coming?"
73.
"Can I get you a drink?" Zig was about to say no, but Elijah had a vibe like an old coach or mentor you didn't want to let down.
"You said it's Zig, right?"
"Z-I-G?" Elijah asked, spelling it out.
He'd been doing it for years, spelling people's names as a way to remember them. Comes in handy when you're tending bar. "And Roddy, yes? R-O-D-D-I-E?
"With a Y," Roddy said.
"R-O-D-D-Y.
"Roddy," Elijah repeated, handing them two empty Pilsner glasses and pointing them to the taps that lined the far right wall. He even blinked slowly, like he was moving in an unhurried time.
"If you got a sweet tooth, the ones on the end are ciders."
Zig liked cider.
"But, come on, not more than free craft beer."
"I got a room in back that's a bit more quiet," Elijah offered as Roddy headed for one of the taps.
"Here's fine," Roddy shot back.
"You sure?" Zig asked with a glance, confused. He scanned the bar. The biggest guy in sight, a heavyset man with a receding hairline and undone tie who was nursing a beer and scrolling through his phone, didn't look like much of a threat, except to his jalapeno poppers. Roddy motioned to the far corner of the bar, to a slight, gangly man with outdated rectangular eyeglasses. Hanging behind his chair was a nylon messenger bag embroidered with the words PRP Consulting. Certainly not a threat. That is, until Roddy pointed down low and Zig finally got a look at the man's ankle holster. Definitely carrying. As before, Roddy didn't miss a detail. That explained why he'd rather be out here. Better to see what's coming, in a crowd and near an exit, than be trapped in back. "It's not working," Roddy said, pulling a tap labeled Hop, Drop, and Roll.
"You need..."
"Here," Elijah said, yanking one of three red wristbands off his wrist and tossing it Roddy's way. When Roddy put it on, he reached again for the tap and, beep, beep, it unlocked, filling his glass with fancy craft beer. "There's a chip inside," Elijah explained, pointing to the red bracelets every customer was wearing. "You buy the wristband, open a tab, and pay by the pour." "Nice gimmick. And even nicer neighborhood," Zig pointed out.
Credit to my ex-brother-in-law, Elijah explained, grabbing a metal mixing bowl from behind the bar and heading for a quiet table in the corner. 3 years ago, he started working in the city commissioner's office. He's the one who gave me the heads up that the town was putting up a minor league baseball stadium a few blocks down. That's what built this place. They tore down the old neighborhood and redid it all. I was first on the block. Took every last dollar I had. But on Saturdays now, people pour out of the stadium and walk right to me. We need extra wristbands those days, he said, straightening out a nearby chair before taking a seat, though he never took his eyes off Roddy. Now tell me about Nola. How's she doing?
Fine.
Hanging in, Zig and Roddy said simultaneously, arriving at the table. Elijah shot them a look. You have no idea where she is, do you?
We do, Zig insisted, taking a seat.
Elijah nodded, tapping his thumbs on the metal bowl, which was filled to the top with loose Starburst candies. That was the sweet and sour smell Zig couldn't place. Elijah used them on trivia nights. Processed sugar? He asked, offering Zig some candy. Elijah was trying to play nice, but he wasn't a moron, and he certainly wasn't buying their story. I realize honesty is more valuable than free Starbursts, Elijah began. But are either of you even assigned to this case, or you just personally invested since Nola is his sister?
Elijah, I know you don't know us, Zig said, trying to keep his voice down. But I swear, I wouldn't be here if I didn't think Nola's life was in danger. Yours too.
You already said that. But you know what I know first and foremost about Nola? She doesn't need saving. And you know what else I know? She only talks to the people she trusts. So if she's not talking to you, you don't understand. I'm not a fool, and neither is she. If she wanted your help, she'd reach out. But that's not the case, is it? You haven't seen her, heard from her, haven't even spoken.
I have, Zig blurted.
Roddy turned, nearly spilling his beer. Back up. You lost me, Elijah said.
Nola, I saw her, spoke to her.
At the funeral home.
You what?
Roddy asked, leaning toward Zig, who was still locked on Elijah.
You saw her too, Zig insisted.
She ran away from me.
You never said...
You spoke to her?
I didn't know she'd be there, Zig insisted.
She surprised me. In the shower. Told me not to say anything.
When?
Elijah asked.
Hours ago.
She's been tracking the Reds.
Who the hell are the Reds? Elijah asked.
My sister.
You spoke to my sister? Roddy asked with a strong tap to Zig's shoulder, trying to get his attention.
Roddy? Not now, Zig said, trying to wave him off.
Elijah, you know she...
Why the hell didn't you tell me? Roddy roared, grabbing Zig's shoulder.
Get off, Zig said, trying to pull free.
Roddy tightened his grip. Annoyed, Zig gripped Roddy's hand, tearing it away.
That was it.
As Zig learned during his years at Dover, things don't go wrong in 3 minutes. They go wrong in 3 seconds. As Zig turned, still trying to pull free, Roddy's eyes went dark, like an internal switch had flipped. One fist gripped Zig's shoulder, the other held tight to the Pilsner glass, holding it like a nightstick. Zig froze. Elijah froze. The whole bar froze, customers turning, the crowd now staring at the sudden and violent shift in the bar's ecosystem. Roddy blinked a few times, looking around, his grip slowly relaxing. In the awkward silence, as adrenaline wore off, Roddy looked. Ashamed was the only word for it.
Mr. Zig, I'm sorry.
I shouldn't have...
Don't,
Zig scolded with a glare that hit like a punch. Everybody, relax. No blood here. They're just doing a mole check for you precancerous middle-agers, Elijah called to the crowd. No one laughed, though the customers... including the consultant with the ankle holster, all quickly returned to their original equilibrium.
Lowering his voice, Elijah turned back to the table. Okay, now that we're all socially uncomfortable, can we get back to Nola? She really came to see you? Trust me, I was just as surprised. But that's the thing about Mint's death. It's got your whole team scurrying, Zig said, carefully eyeing Elijah's reaction. Nola comes to see me. OJ comes to see you. Elijah froze. Who told you Colonel Whatley was here? The old woman with the rhinestoned oxygen tank owns the clay store. Elijah sighed. Miss Niecy. Lord, is she a pain in everyone's ass. That doesn't answer my question. You didn't ask one. All you did was come inside, throwing accusations. As for OJ, he's doing what he's always doing, looking out for OJ. I'm not a fan either, Zig admitted, noticing the way Roddy had shrunk in his seat, like he was punishing himself. Tell me about Nola. What did she say? Elijah asked, picking up some loose starbursts and resetting a stack of coasters that got knocked over on the table. He was trying to look casual, but his voice was clearly impatient. We talked about that night, about the robbery at Grandma's pantry. Most important, I told her I was coming to see you, Zig explained. She didn't object, which tells me, well, considering Nola hates everyone, somehow, some way, she thinks you might be one of the few people who's worthy of some trust. Elijah gripped the stacked coasters, squaring them like a deck of just shuffled cards, then squared them again for no good reason. Flattery? You're playing the old Nolan nostalgia card and using flattery on me? Is it working? I haven't decided. Then let me be clear. You've got two team members dead. I'm trying to prevent a third. Nola told me about the robbery, that something was snuck inside. If you know what it was, what they put into the warehouse, not what, Elijah interrupted. Excuse me? Zig asked. That night at Grandma's pantry. You said what they put into the warehouse. It wasn't a thing, Elijah explained. What they snuck inside. It was a person. 74. 5 years ago. Chaz, salty Trebbiano, always kept a $2 bill in his wallet. For good luck, his father used to say, though Salty never believed in such nonsense. Over the course of his 62 years, Salty had never been in a car accident, never broken a bone, never had a cavity. Even still, had a head of thick gray hair that matched his gunmetal eyes. 6 months ago, however, Salty's luck ran out. This part of my punishment, the old man complained from the back seat. Just for that, I'm turning it up, said the U.S. Marshal who was driving, a thin Asian woman who, 2 years back, had broken both ankles, but still caught the perp when she jumped from the upper deck of a bridge to the lower deck. Her name was Piper Grace Lynn, though everyone called her PG. With a twist, she raised the volume on the radio. Don't take it so personally, Salty said. I'm not an audiobook guy. It's Sherlock friggin' Holmes, said Titus Huddleston, the other marshal in the car, a beefy 28-year-old Mississippian who spent most of the ride thinking about his upcoming trials for the U.S. Olympic 50-meter riflery team. He was sitting next to Salty in the back seat. Who are you to not like Sherlock Holmes? Salty shrugged, a light jingle coming from his handcuffed wrists and the connected belly chain. 6 months ago, he'd been arrested for a dozen murders that stemmed from the multi-million-dollar weapons supply route he ran, selling illegal guns to white nationalists from Virginia to Texas. Early this morning, Salty testified against his old buyers in exchange for some plastic surgery and a new name. In Marshall's parlance, he became a client. PG and Titus's job was to keep him alive during the six-hour ride from the Virginia courthouse to their destination, Otisville Federal Prison in upstate New York. When you enter witness protection, you don't just leave your trial and race to your new hometown. All across the country, certain prisons had private security wings that specialized in keeping witnesses safe until their new identities were ready.
"I'll give you $5,000 apiece to put on some music. 10 to play Sinatra," Salty teased.
PG rolled her eyes, making Sherlock Holmes even louder. Annoyed, Salty stared out into the darkness, thinking of the old treadmill he always picked at the gym, to get the best view of the girl at the check-in desk with the lush eyelashes. 10 minutes later, PG glanced at the car's digital clock, nearly midnight, and it felt like it as they hit one of those stretches of highway where you can't quite remember the last few miles or what the hell you were just thinking. That is, until the bright lights of another car, an SUV from the height of it, appeared in the distance behind them. PG noticed it first, squinting at the lights in the rearview. On the seat next to her was what they codenamed a Witsec shotgun, meaning it had a cut-down barrel to move and aim easier in the close confines of a vehicle. Titus gave her a look, reminding her that his own gun was in the front glove box. "If you ride in back with the prisoner, you're not allowed to be armed." The SUV picked up speed, pulling neck and neck, then quickly blew past them. As the SUV disappeared into the darkness, Sherlock Holmes pointed out that life is infinitely stranger than anything the man of mine could invent.
"Okay. Forget the stupid audiobook," Salty said. $50,000 if you can find us a Starbucks or a proper cup of..."
"Whoa. You feel that?" PG interrupted. Titus nodded. "Flat tire." Salty looked around, confused.
"Feels good to me."
"It's not," PG insisted as she and Titus exchanged a glance. Didn't matter that the highway was empty, or that in front of them, the faint red taillights of the SUV were barely visible. When you have a client, you don't just pull over.
"We need a port," PG said, "a place where Salty would be safe."
Titus was already scrolling on his phone, looking for the usuals. Nearby police stations, firehouses, even a hospital if need be.
"Got one," Titus said. He pointed up ahead. "Here, get off at this exit."
PG tugged the wheel as the car veered toward the exit ramp in Industrial, New Jersey. In the back seat, Salty glanced around, still lost.
"Doesn't feel like a flat."
"Definitely is," PG said, though both she and her partner knew that wasn't true.
"Titus, how much farther?"
"A few miles. Not far."
He was right about that. 15 minutes later, they were at Grandma's pantry. 75. Grandma's pantry. 5 years ago. By the time they entered the warehouse, they'd told Salty the truth, or at least most of it.
"I gotta say, I thought both of yous was retards," Salty said with a laugh. "God, I love being wrong."
He was still in handcuffs and leg irons, shuffling down a wide aisle that looked like a meticulously clean Costco, though instead of being stocked with pallets of industrial-sized mayonnaise and 6-pound cans of tomato sauce, this aisle was filled with tall, refrigerator-sized boxes. Salty was too excited to notice they were labeled ventilators, each with a cord running out of the box to charge them once a month.
"What the hell is this place anyway? Feels like a morgue," he said, looking around and realizing they were the only ones in the entire building.
He glanced up at the massive American flag that hung from the wide back wall.
"Or maybe that warehouse in X-Files?"
"What's X-Files?" PG asked.
"Like CSI, but with aliens and..."
"You know what, forget it," Salty said, trying to throw his hands in the air, though his cuffs were still connected to the belly chain.
"Salty, how about you stop running your mouth and start moving your ass?" Titus asked, giving him a shove from behind.
In truth, Salty had thought this meeting was going to take place a few days ago at the courthouse, where it's usually done. When that didn't happen, he assumed they'd set it up at the prison. But leave it to the marshals to fake a flat tire and bring him to the one place no one would ever think to look.
"Should be unlocked," PG said, pointing them to their destination, a metal door with a latch that looked like...
"A freezer?" Salty asked. his voice echoing through the cavernous room. You made her wait in a walk-in freezer? Relax, it's not even on. Still being installed, Titus explained.
Salty nodded like it made perfect sense. In a warehouse this big, better to find a smaller space. But what PG and Titus didn't mention was that the freezer was one of the only places in the building with no cameras.
My kind of place, Salty teased, pumping his shoulders with a little strut, like he was on the way to his own surprise party and already secretly knew everyone was gonna be there. In reality, Salty had no idea what was coming.
How long's she been waiting? Salty asked.
Ask her yourself, PG said, grabbing the door's metal latch and giving it a tug. When you enter the WITSEC program, the first rule is simple. No contact. No contact with your relatives. No contact with your former neighbors. No contact with your previous life. They'll tell you there's no way around it, but as with any gatekeeper, they'll make exceptions. For an elderly parent dying, a sick sibling, or, in the worst of all scenarios, if something happens to your child. The freezer door swung outward, revealing a row of clear plastic slats that hung like vertical blinds. Salty squinted to make sure he was seeing it right. Through the slats, in an office rolling chair, was a scrawny woman. 35 years old, though she looked twice that, her pink floral leukemia scarf askew on her head. Her face was gaunt, her eyes sunken, her skin so pale and brittle she was practically see-through.
Dad? She whispered. Pop-Tart, Salty said, his voice cracking, tears filling his eyes.
Salty started running toward her, not even realizing PG was unlocking his handcuffs. Plowing through the plastic slats, he embraced his daughter Melinda, pulling her close, one of the cuffs still hanging from his wrist. The impact knocked her scarf from her head, tumbling across her shoulder. Salty closed his eyes, hating to see her bald, but still thinking she was the most beautiful girl in the world.
Pop-Tart, he repeated, starting to sob. I'm here. I'm here. I'm right.
Click. Salty heard it before he felt it. Something cold at his neck. He started to turn. PG pushed harder, pressing the barrel of her gun into the back of Salty's head. There was another click as Titus did the same to Salty's daughter, pointing his gun at her pale bald skull. Salty took a breath through his nose, slowly raising his hands in the air. He knew things had been going too well. This is why everyone hates the feds, he said. You know, as a white nationalist piece of trash, you really shouldn't look so shocked that you bring out the worst in people, PG said. Now step away from your daughter. Titus, both of you, be smart. Whatever you want, I can pay. I've got money. We know you do, jackass. Just like we know what you two were planning for this little meeting, since it clearly wasn't just about her cancer. Now, PG cocked her gun and gripped the trigger, pressing it even harder against Salty's head. Titus and I have a proposition for you.
76. Grafton, New Jersey. Today.
So it was a lemon drop, Roddy said. Let me say it like this, Elijah began, getting up from the table with his empty water glass and heading for the wall of taps. Lemon drops always smell like lemon drops.
I'm lost, Zig said, taking his own sip of beer. What the hell's a lemon drop?
Special delivery. When you try to sneak something to someone, especially something sweet, Roddy explained, glancing out the front window, eyeing the 20-somethings up the block who were still zipping on scooters up and down the street. Looks like a normal meeting. Two guys saying hi. But what you don't see is that as they go in for the bro hug, they pass a note or a phone. In jail once, we caught a mom trying to pass her son a diamond stud earring that she was hiding in her mouth.
Elijah approached the tap on the far left, closest to their table, and there was a beep-beep as he poured a cider named Suicider. It was the same with Salty and his dying daughter.
So the daughter really had cancer.
Elijah finished his pour and didn't say a word until he returned to the table. Stage 4 leukemia. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, he finally explained, glancing over his own shoulder for a quick scan of the bar. Everyone was lost in their own conversations. But that night at Grandma's pantry, Salty didn't give two turds about his daughter's cancer. His real goal was his very own lemon drop. As he hugged her goodbye, he was going to secretly whisper in her ear the bank account number for the $22 million in arms profits he'd been hiding from the government. Son of a bitch, Zig said, literally and figuratively. According to the warehouse's security cameras, at 11:43 p.m., all four of them met up inside the walk-in freezer. 6 minutes after that, the freezer door opened. Salty and his daughter were both dead at the marshal's hands, multiple bullet wounds to the head and chest. So you're saying the marshals? You think they killed Salty and his daughter to get their money? That's why our unit got the call, Elijah explained, taking a sip of Suicider and grabbing an orange starburst. They needed an outside investigative team with no dog in the fight. Within an hour of the shooting, Colonel Mint's phone rang. Then he reached out to me and Rashida. Why you? Roddy interrupted. Peeling open the orange starburst, Elijah shot a look at Roddy. Anyone ever teach him manners? Elijah asked Zig. I looked up the jurisdiction, Roddy said. Security for Grandma's pantry is done by the Marshals Service, which explains why PG and Titus picked that as a meeting place. But if there's a break-in or a murder, that's a federal building, meaning jurisdiction goes to the FBI. So why did a top-secret military unit, Semper Vigilis, get the call? Zig stared at Elijah, who was now chewing on his starburst, a fat round lump in his cheek. It was a good question. Military blood, Elijah finally said. Pardon? The SNS storehouses were designed to keep civilians safe. But if you've got the right clearance, you know they also have an additional mission. DOD storage, Elijah explained, referring to the Department of Defense. All the extra blood for our troops, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, plus all military force protection from Ebola, smallpox, and all the rest. The warehouses store all of it. So when those gunshots went off that night, Pentagon phones started ringing off the hook. They thought it was a foreign attack? Zig asked. Let me say it like this, Elijah said, pulling another starburst, a yellow one from the bowl. 3,000 service members have been killed in Afghanistan. But you tamper with our spare blood or the vaccinations that are stored in these warehouses, we'd be burying our young men and women by the battalions. It made Zig think of those days at Dover when U.S. troops were helping battle Ebola in Liberia. Contaminated bodies weren't allowed to be sent home. Instead, they were bagged and put in mass graves. Crack of dawn the following morning, Mint, Rashida, and I arrived at Grandma's pantry. Nola showed up an hour or so later, Elijah explained, his voice slowing down as he tossed the yellow starburst back in the bowl unopened. All his ease was gone, like he was suddenly talking about his own funeral. Truthfully, it was a pretty standard sweep, examining the blood spatter, collecting footage from security cams. What did the marshals PG and Titus, Elijah corrected. Exactly. What did PG and Titus have to say? That's the question, isn't it? Mint and the rest of us interrogated them for 2 hours. According to PG and Titus, they were simply doing their jobs, facilitating a final father-daughter visit in an SNS storehouse, one of the most secure facilities in the country. The location was a bit odd, but otherwise, it's standard procedure. But when they started questioning Salty about his missing $22 million, they said that's when the old man lost his temper, charging straight at them and trying to grab their guns. In the close confines of the freezer, well, you know how these things go. We were just trying to defend ourselves. They were lying, Roddy said, his focus across the room at the consultant with the ankle holster.
Of course they were lying, Elijah said.
So what did they say when you confronted them? Zig asked.
It was actually kind of hard to tell, considering PG and Titus were both found dead later that same night, face down in a gravel parking lot of what had to be one of the very last Bennigans in the country.
Single shots to the temple.
Military kills, Elijah said, putting a finger gun to his own head and pulling the pretend trigger. Oh, and Salty's 22 million. Right after our interrogation. Poof! The 22 million suddenly magically disappeared as well.
Oh, crap, Zig muttered, nearly knocking over his beer.
Oh, crap, for sure. According to the timestamp on the wire transfer, the money went missing right after our interrogation.
So when it came to making the suspect list, it went downhill from there.
77.
So they thought someone from your team stole the money.
That's when the full hurricane hit, Elijah said, fidgeting with the bowl of starbursts. They started pointing fingers at me, at Mint and Rashida, at Nola. For all we knew, it could have been someone on the inside at the Marshals, or the white nationalists, taking revenge for shooting their pal Salty, Zig pointed out. We told them the same. None of us knew what happened to the money, but in the military, when two of your suspects suddenly show up dead and $22 million goes missing, they had to launch an internal inquiry, led by everyone's favorite uptight sphincter, Colonel O.J. Watley, Major Watley back then. He had a year on me, 2 years on Mint, but we'd all come up together, Elijah explained. The fact they put him on the case showed he was pulling ahead, and to prove them all right, he dove right in. The first person he cleared was, surprise, everyone's favorite straight arrow, his pal Mint.
How'd they know Mint was clean? Roddy asked.
They didn't, but at military bases, you know those private side entrances that they have on buildings, the ones just for top commanders so they can feel important? Mint had access to those entrances, but he always walked through the regular door with the rest of us. No question OJ would clear him first. Then he cleared Rashida, despite the fact that everyone knew she and Mint sometimes did use those side entrances, since they were sleeping together for the better part of a year. And then, let me say it like this, he blamed it on you and Nola, Zig said. Elijah started to laugh, a low rumble that sounded like it came from the Earth's core. OJ couldn't point the finger at us without evidence, but in the right hands, there's an art to properly wrecking someone's military career. To make us pay, he issued a finding of no fault. Nothing bad, nothing good. The death knell for an officer who needs good reports for promotions. Nola got sent back to her command. As artist in residence, it didn't change much for her. But for me, career-wise, it was enough of a stink that I was done. My next evaluation was, let's just say, below center mass. From there, I had a choice. Get passed up for promotion or leave Army life behind. For OJ, it was a hell of a chess move. Bloodless execution. Roddy cocked his head. Why'd he want to single you out? Have you met OJ? He's a proud black man who was determined to make full bird colonel, then general. At the time, I was a proud black man also trying to make colonel, then general. Guess how many spots for proud black generals he thought there were? I'll give you a hint. Him and only him, Elijah said, raising his glass in a mock toast. That first year, at nearly 40 years old, the best job I could find was working alcohol concessions for the Trenton Tigers, he added, referring to the local minor league NHL team. Though God bless it for showing me the power of beer. 3 minority-owned business loans later, I was able to... Can we go back to last night? Zig interrupted.
You said OJ was here at the bar, asking questions.
What was he? Nola, Elijah said. That's the only thing he cared about. Wanted to know where she was. Had I seen her? Did I know who she was with?
Roddy whispered, more to himself than anyone else. What did you tell him? Zig asked.
You're joking, right? That walking piece of excrement wrecked my life. You really think I'd tell him what I found?
Zig's ears perked up. He shot Elijah a look. Roddy did too. Mr. Elijah, what do you know about my sister?
Elijah unwrapped another starburst, a red one. An awkward silence hung in the air.
Elijah, please. We're on your side here, Zig said. You see what this case is doing to Nola. The way she's sneaking around, making mistakes she never makes. You should have seen the way her hands were shaking. She's clearly at the core of this. And you obviously have something you're not saying.
Elijah sat there silently, popping the red candy in his mouth. Did he trust these two? Not really. But in the end, if they were here to help Nola, then by extension, maybe they could help him. If I had answers, you'd have them already, Elijah said. All I've got is a theory, okay?
What kind of theory? Zig challenged.
When OJ strolled in here last night, all smiles and charm, I'll just say it pissed me off, which I'm not proud of, but that's what it did. It's the only reason I even took a look.
A look at what? Zig asked.
Employment records, Elijah said. You have to understand. All those years ago, when everything went down at Grandma's pantry, the government fired everyone who worked there, every staffer who was anywhere near the storehouse that night, the warehouse supervisor, the vaccine manager on call, the lift operator, all the security guys, of course, even the maintenance and janitorial staff. But last night, when OJ left, I couldn't help myself. I called a buddy who does surveillance work for the Pentagon. He owes me for setting him up with his second wife. The point being, I asked him to pull the staff list for Grandma's pantry. Accidentally, he sent me the current list rather than the old one.
I'm not sure I follow, Zig said.
You will. On the list was a guy named Axel Padilla.
Zig made a face. The name didn't ring a bell.
He's a security guard at Grandma's pantry, Elijah explained. Low-level guy, one of the many hired by the marshals.
Back then or now? Zig asked.
That's the kicker. Axel is a pretty memorable name, which made me look twice at it. And then I saw it, glowing on my computer screen. Axel Padilla is on the current list of guards, but also on the original list from 5 years ago.
I thought you said the marshals fired everyone.
That's what I thought. Except, apparently, for a guy named Axel. He's the one and only person who was there on the night when Salty was killed, the next day when the 22 million went missing, and also, for reasons that defy all logic, still somehow has a job working security there today.
Zig sat there a moment, watching a few stray bubbles rise in his craft beer.
Think he's a whistleblower? That was my thought. Though he could be anything, Elijah said, knowing there were plenty of cases where a whistleblower was so helpful, the government brought them back to the job once the disaster passed.
This guy Axel, where's he right now? Zig asked.
I have no clue. He was a night guy, so maybe at work?
It's a good idea, Zig said, taking a final swig of beer and heading for the door.
Where the hell are you going? Elijah asked.
You tell me.
Do you know where Grandma's pantry is?
Yeah, but...
Great, Zig said.
Show me.
78.
His favorite part was picking the music. Today, most elevators have stopped playing overhead music, but when you buy your own, you can choose to play whatever you want. According to a leading communications expert, music in an elevator is like amniotic fluid that surrounds us. It never startles us. It is never too loud. It's always there. It's why the saleswoman at Atlas Elevator suggested soundtracks with names like Easy Listening and Calm Pop. You want to be in the background, not the foreground, she'd told him. But screw it. Who the hell wants to live life in the background, he'd decided, picking a soundtrack with Grandmaster Flash and a ton of Marvin Gaye. Indeed, his office was so quiet, as the elevator made its way up, he could hear the faint beat of Got to Give It Up. Within seconds, the green digital indicator light lit up, but didn't ping. They'd turned the ping off months ago for being too annoying. The elevator doors slid open as the man craned his neck, looking to see just how bad the rest of his day would be. Sure enough, Nola stormed out of the elevator, pistol at the ready. She spotted the man instantly, in the open doorway of his office. He had a knife of a nose and a leprechaun smile. Nola plowed toward him, her pistol aimed straight at his face. Her lower lip was split. At least Dominic got a lucky punch in. Relax. I'm not your enemy. Not even armed, he insisted, hands in the air, signaling his own surrender. Friends, okay? Friends? Adrian Vess, he said, offering a handshake. Nola stayed silent, her finger on the trigger. I know you're the one who did this. I hate to break it to you, kid, but you don't know nothing, Mr. Vess said, hand still in the air. Heading for his office, he motioned for her to follow. Now come on. I got something you're gonna like, he added, his leprechaun smile widening. I promise. I won't bite. 79. Landenburg, Pennsylvania.
Suck it, fart wizard!
Kevin! Nana Dottie scolded, her grandson barely reacting.
Apologies, Ms. Wags, he's just... Boys are animals.
I have a son, Wags agreed, sitting at a tiny faux wood kitchen table that was built for two, but had three seats around it. From a mug that read, What happens at Grandma's stays at Grandma's, Wags pretended to enjoy the instant coffee that had all the flavor of backwash. In the living room, two boys, Kevin and his brother, were frantically jumping on a sagging orange couch, playing an old Wii baseball video game like it was a cardio workout.
Swallow that,
the shorter boy yelled, hitting what appeared to be a digital triple.
Pull,
Nana Dottie shouted, wearing a sheen of exhaustion that only comes when you're 80 years old and your daughter's opioid habit leaves you raising two tween boys.
You were saying about his accident, Wags began.
Actually, ma'am.
I hadn't said anything, Nana Dottie replied, taking a long sip of coffee. My daughter's been arrested 5 times, Ms. Wags.
So forgive me for being suspicious when someone with a badge knocks on my door.
Wags took a breath, noticing that above the stove, above the fridge, above every single doorway, including the bathroom, was a metal horseshoe for good luck. Right about now, she needed it.
Can we go back to his brain injury?
You wouldn't even know from looking at him.
Wags nodded, eyeing Paul, the younger of the two boys, swinging his Wii controller like a bat. He limped slightly, his movements jerky, like his left side wasn't wired quite right. But the way he kept shoving his older brother, Paul had real swagger, even at age 9.
Ever been in a car accident, Ms. Wags?
On that night, they were 2 blocks away. Literally, 2 blocks, Nana said, her body shifting as she relived the moment.
It was late.
And Paul, he'd just turned 6 and had fallen asleep. So Casey, my daughter, when she carried him to the car, it was 2 blocks. So she let him lay across the back seat. No seatbelt. The other car, it was moving full speed and coming head on.
Oh no.
Nana didn't say anything else. She just shook her head, her thumbnail scratching at a nick in her coffee mug.
The way his skull split.
Dr. Sandberg said we should prepare for the worst.
Wags looked over at the two boys who were still lost in their video game.
3 months later, Nana explained, he wakes up out of the coma, asking to watch Sesame Street, which I swear he hadn't watched since he was little. A month after that, he's running around. With a limp, sure, but running around like nothing ever happened. Our pastor called it a miracle. That's the only word for it. Same word your friend used. The painter.
Nola, Wags and Nana said simultaneously.
Wags nodded, though miracle didn't sound like a word that Nola ever used. That is, unless she was trying to get a grandmother's permission to paint young Paul.
One last question, Wags began. Why do you say yes?
Pardon?
With your grandsons. You seem quite protective, rightfully so. But if that's the case, why do you let Nola into your house to do a painting?
At first, Nana Dottie didn't answer.
Ma'am, if Nola did something, or threatened you, she paid me. $100, okay? And before you give me a look, you know what it takes to feed growing boys? And the physical therapy on top of that?
She pointed over to both boys standing on her couch, shouting at the TV.
You want to pay me to paint my grandkid for an hour? You can come to my house every damn night.
Wags nodded, glancing at Paul, then picturing the two senior citizens who she'd visited at the other two facilities earlier today. Three different patients, three different incidents, three different outcomes. The only thing they had in common, a traumatic brain injury, and a near impossible recovery. At that, Wags replayed Lieutenant Colonel Mint 3 nights ago, sitting in the back seat of his car, a single bullet burrowing into his head. Was that what Nola was looking for? Did she know Mint's murder was coming, and she was trying to help him survive the attack? Or did she have a hand in it? Was she the one who was supposed to pull the trigger, and she was trying to figure out how to do the least amount of damage? It made Wags think back to last night. To Nola curled down like a fist in Wags's back seat. Whatever was really going on, Nola wasn't gunning for Colonel Mint. She was hurt by his death, reminding Wags of what Zig said, that Roddy was asking his own questions. At first, Wags had assumed Roddy was looking for Nola. But what if that was the part Wags had wrong? What if Nola was the one looking for him? It was a fair question, especially considering everything Nola asked about Black House. What was it she said? That she saw someone in Mint's account?
Wait. Mint's Black House account.
Pulling out her phone and excusing herself from the table, Wags dialed a number she never liked dialing. It rang once, twice.
What is it, my precious?
A man teased in a poor Lord of the Rings impression. Gary, I need you to not be weird for once. Just tell me, when someone logs into Black House, do we keep a record of where they're logging in from?
80. You're the one who hired the Reds, Nola said, her gun aimed at his face.
Mr. Vess rolled his eyes, which were brown and threaded with hints of orange. He was pear-shaped, with copper skin and a slicked-back expensive haircut that came to a perfect widow's peak.
New money or old money?
Nola eyed the intricate gold chain around his neck, made up of tiny male and female figures intertwined in a sexual 69 position.
New money.
You do realize you can lower the gun, Vess said without looking back as Nola followed him into his office. He didn't seem upset. Emotional sweat, from stress, fear, or pain, is most evident on the palms, forehead, and some sweat patterns on the scalp. Mr. Vess had none of it. If anything, he seemed polished. Fancy tan loafers, matching belt, and a fashionably untucked white shirt that was clearly altered to hide his girth. But no amount of money could hide the odd slant of his knuckles on his pinky and ring fingers. Boxer's break, they called it, from fighting barehanded. Nola made a note. Plus the fact he led with his right.
Water? Seltzer? Vess offered, pronouncing each word slowly, carefully, with true precision. Former stutterer? Or just trying to impress with... Nolan never finished the thought. As she entered his office, she caught sight of his look at all the art. There was a canvas on each wall, plus a triptych behind his antique partner's desk. She lowered her gun without even realizing. Most corporate artwork is picked to match the color of the walls, or worse, modern trash that's expensive only because it came from an overpriced gallery. But these? You like the paintings, Mr. Vess said. Nola did, though she'd never say it. Each was an oil painting, though none of them felt stuffy or old. On the left wall was a woman in profile, her sundress bathed in light as she cupped and admired a pink rose, reminding Nola of a classic waterhouse. Another, a steep cliffside with a tangerine sky and a thunderstorm, reminded her of a Delacroix. This was a curated collection. For a moment, she told herself this was what she never wanted, art captured and locked away. But God, did she love being so close to something this good. Don't look so shocked that I've got taste, Vess said. He also had Frogger, Nola noticed, eyeing the video game in the corner. You a fan? Want to play? He asked, following her gaze to the machine. He was sharp, more observant than she expected, and unafraid to use it to his advantage. He didn't get here just by those crooked knuckles. Your loss. I got first game, Vess said, heading for Frogger. Nola raised her gun again. She had a commander who used to do this, act like he didn't have a care. But men in charge, they always have a care. Ask whatever you came to ask, Vess said, hitting the two-up button as the Frogger theme started to play. I know about Zion Lopez, Nola said, lowering her gun, though not by much. I was at his house. I don't know who that is. That was a lie. She knew it before he even touched his gold chain, running his fingertips along the length of the naked figures. Zion called you a few hours before he died, she explained. He's a petty drug dealer. My theory is, you're his supplier. Maybe you brought him in for some odd jobs. Vess tapped the joystick upward, eyes never leaving the screen. You know why I love this game? You move the frog and go home. That's it. One simple objective. Don't you wish life was as clear as that? Mr. Vess, I want to know about Archie Mint, Vess said. Nola froze. There was a loud blink as Frogger leaped into one of his frog homes at the top of the screen. Vess was still in profile, his shoulders back. No fear at all. Colonel Mint, Nola corrected, feeling the gun in her hand, her finger sliding toward the trigger. Oh, come on. I knew that'd be your first question, Vess said, his fist tightening around the joystick. I told you from the start, I'm on your side. Archie Mint may have loved playing the Golden Boy, but don't you want to know what he was doing in private?
81.
Lower the gun, Vess insisted. I told you. I want the same thing you... Pulling back the slide and cocking the gun, Nola aimed it at Vess's foot and pulled the trigger. A tiny black hole appeared near the big toe of Vess's shoe. A crimson puddle bubbled up, then disappeared, like a broken water fountain. It took half a second before he realized it was his blood and screamed out in pain. My toe! You shunned my toe! He exploded, hopping backward and holding the Frogger machine for balance. Are you out of your fucking... She pointed the gun at his leg. I'm gonna shoot you in the calf next, then work my way to your femur. I broke my femur before. You won't like it, she said. Your pain is now in your hands. Tell me what you know about Colonel Mint. Do you understand what I'm gonna do to you for... Nola aimed at his calf and pulled the trigger. Vess felt a needle prick, a bite of electricity. Instinctively, he swatted at his calf, but was already off balance, falling sideways and crashing to the floor.
Gah! What in the hell is...
Why would you do that?
He clenched his teeth, pulling off his leather belt to make a makeshift tourniquet. He'd been shot before, or saw a few too many war movies.
Christ almighty, that hurts,
he shouted, his face already going pale.
Why would you? I said I was on your side.
I want to know about Colonel Mint.
What do you think I was trying to?
She pointed the gun at his thigh, her finger on the trigger.
Stop, stop, just listen. Zion, he...
I know Zion pulled the trigger on Mint. I also know Zion worked for you. He sold drugs for you. You're a street boss, maybe a state boss if you're lucky. That's correct, yes? He was your employee? Vess nodded over and over, his eyes starting to flood with tears. Snot ran from his nose. His leprechaun smile was gone.
My leg. I need a doctor.
Mr. Vess, look at me. Are you looking? I need you to think carefully about your next words. When Zion killed Mint, did you give Zion that order?
I swear on my life, on my daughter's life. Zion's a dreamer, all hustle, a little spick CEO. Sold Molly and K2 like they were Tickle Me Elmos on Christmas. That's why I brought him on. But with Mint? My hand to God, Zion was freelancing, and he knew. I don't stand for freelancing.
So you called the Reds.
You think I had a choice? He killed a local military hero. That's like... it's like putting a bullet in the head of the mayor. You know how many eyes that brings toward Zion? Toward my business? That's why I told you. I'm on your side. Whoever hired Zion to kill Mint, I want to find them just as much as you do.
Another lie. Or at least a partial one. Vess wasn't in this for justice. He wanted containment to keep his drug enterprise from being exposed, which was all too likely when Zion suddenly brought it this much attention. Still, that explained why the Reds turned their attention to Zig, and presumably anyone else sniffing where they weren't supposed to. But it still didn't make sense. The Reds were pros. When they went to see Zion, they wouldn't have left without asking the most vital question. This is your femoral artery, Nola said, digging the barrel of her gun into his thigh. If you bleed out, you're gonna ruin these nice floors. So tell me, Mr. Vess, who hired Zion to kill Mint? 82. Vess's hands were shaking, still struggling to knot the belt around his calf. As he fought to pull it tight, blood was already soaking the cuff of his pants.
Did you really have to shoot me?
Nola started to squeeze the trigger.
On my desk! There's photos! The iPad! That's what they sent me! Hand to God, that's what I was... that's what I wanted to show you!
Stop talking, Nola said, heading for his desk. As she grabbed the iPad, she couldn't help but steal another quick glance at his paintings.
The passcode is all zeros, Vess called out.
Nola rolled her eyes. A few clicks later, she was staring at a text from a 215 number. Philadelphia. No written message, just two photos. The first of Mint and Rashida sitting at a table in what looked like a nice restaurant. This wasn't the steakhouse. It was somewhere else. It had a hidden camera feel, both of them smiling and leaning toward each other in a way that former co-workers weren't supposed to lean toward each other. From the crow's feet at Mint's eyes, this wasn't an old photo. This was recent.
You see it, right?
Like a dog in heat. At Mint's funeral, they filled a gymnasium. Pennsylvania's local hero and golden Boy Scout. But he was just another cheater, sleeping around on his wife with some black piece of... With a violent kick, Nola pounded her heel into Vess's wound.
Fah!
He screamed, rolling sideways, hugging his knee toward his chin. Who sent these? Nola asked, swiping to the iPad's next photo. It was a screenshot, literally. Someone had held up their phone to snap a picture of a computer screen. The image was pixelated and harder to read, but it looked like an online bank statement. On the far right were deposits,
Dozens of them, at least one a day. $8,500, $9,500, $9,200, always just below $10,000, the amount that Nola knew triggered banks to send a report to the IRS. Whoever this money belonged to, they were working hard not to be seen. In the last month alone, total deposits were over $242,000. Account name, Mint, Archibald C. A sharp pain stabbed Nola's throat, like she'd swallowed a needle that sliced her as it descended toward her stomach. Mint was in the reserves, making $60,000 a year. Where was he suddenly getting this cash? "You said the Reds found these photos?" she asked. "On Zion's phone," Vess explained, still clenching his leg in pain. Nola closed her eyes, the iPad feeling like an anvil in her hand. "Mongol, Faber, Stettler." "Salty Trebbiano," Nola announced. "Does that name mean anything to you?" Vess glanced upward, clearly lost. Nola swiped back to the first photo of Mint and Rashida eating at the restaurant. Slowly, finally, the walls of the maze were starting to crumble. 5 years ago at Grandma's Pantry, arms dealer Salty Trebbiano was killed, and his $22 million went missing. After Mint and the rest of his Semper Vigilis team raced in to investigate, two dirty U.S. Marshals also showed up dead, turning every person there, Mint, Rashida, Elijah, and of course Nola herself, into instant suspects. In the weeks that followed, O.J. drove the internal review. To this day, Nola assumed one of Salty's white supremacist groups was behind it all, but in the end, the only truth was this. Whoever took the money got away with it. That is, Nola thought, until a few years passed, and maybe they finally started spending it. With another swipe at the iPad, Nola glanced down at Mint's bank account, now flush with nearly $250,000 in the last month alone. The needle in her throat expanded, thick as a nail, pushing out from inside her skin. Nola shook her head, praying she had it wrong. All these years, all the good Mint had done, all he'd done for her. "Sir, you're supposed to be better than this." Just the thought of it made her feel gutted, exposed, and so damn naive. It also made her feel something else, like someone was yanking an ancient piece of armor from her chest, one that she didn't even realize she'd been wearing. She replayed it all, reshuffling the details. From the photo, it looked like Mint was once again cheating on his wife with Rashida. That she could deal with. Good men make dumb decisions every day. But did that mean that he was the one who killed two U.S. Marshals and took $22 million that night at Grandma's Pantry? Maybe. Or maybe someone else took it, and Mint, or Rashida, somehow found out about it. Could that be where Mint's deposits were coming from? A hush payment? Or Mint asking for his own cut? That actually made more sense, especially considering the one trap door at the center of the maze, that Mint and Rashida were dead. Someone ordered that hit, and from the sums in Mint's account, that money came from somewhere. Find the missing $22 million, and she'd find who was really behind this. It wasn't a long suspect list. With a final swipe backward, Nola spread her fingers, enlarging the original photo of Mint and Rashida. With them gone, the only remaining team members from Grandma's Pantry were OJ and... "Elijah," Nola blurted. "The guy with the bar," Vess said, still clutching his leg on the floor. Nola turned. "What did you say?" "Elijah. That's his name, right?" Vess said. "The Reds. They mentioned him. Said he had a bar, selling faggoty microbrews." "Who told them that?" "No idea. They said..." Nola leaned closer, giving Vess a deep, long look at the fight he didn't realize he was picking. Later tonight, Vess would still be thinking about her stare. Her eyes were patient, like they knew something was coming. There weren't many people who knew about Elijah, much less that he had a bar. Zig was one. though he'd never share info with the Reds, which left.
Mr. Vess, how do you know my brother?
Nola asked.
Your brother? Roddy LaPointe. He's a cop in Jersey and a general scumbag. You're a drug boss in Philly, barely an hour and a half from each other. You're telling me that's just coincidence?
Vess stopped, glancing up. He was still in pain, but his brow was furrowed. He looked lost, confused.
Roddy? That's an actual name? Roddy?
Vess didn't know him. It made no sense. To track Vess here, Nola had relied on his listing in the Special Identities Unit. It was a watchdog list, the ultimate do not disturb, usually for people the government had under surveillance. But one of the other biggest groups on that list? CIs. Confidential informants. Some were petty criminals, but some were bosses themselves, ratting out their fellow scumbags, hoping that the government or even a local cop might turn a blind eye or somehow take it easy on them.
So you're not Roddy's informant? Nola asked.
That's not how your paths first crossed?
If I'm gonna rat, you really think I'd pick a dink cop? At least bring in the feds, he stuttered, though it sounded like an insult.
She pointed her gun at Vess's head.
Mr. Vess, I want to know who told the Reds about Elijah.
This guy Elijah. You think he's the one who did this?
She grabbed the trigger and quickly pulled.
Ask them! Ask the Reds! I don't know shit! I swear on my daughter!
Nola stood there for half a second, pressing her gun into Vess's widow's beak. His face was white, not from fear. He was losing blood, fast.
Email or phone? She asked.
I don't understand.
When the Reds contacted you, email or
phone? It's in my desk. Top drawer,
Vess insisted. Crossing to the other side of the desk, Nola pulled out an old Motorola flip phone that reminded her of a girl she used to hate in junior high. On the corner of the desk, next to the keyboard, she spotted a new iPhone. She grabbed that, too.
Yo, that's my phone! You can't... I need that to call an ambulance,
Vess shouted. Nola was already at the door, checking the passcode. All zeros again, moron.
I'm serious. If you leave and I pass out...
Vess was still yelling as Nola stepped into the elevator and pulled out her own phone, dialing Zig's number. No answer. She glanced at the time. For sure he would have reached Elijah's by now, or even Grandma's pantry. Zig had no idea about the $22 million, or what he was walking into. Nola pounded the door close button with the heel of her hand.
You're never gonna get there in time,
Vess shouted as the doors slid shut.
Your friend the mortician? If he's headed there, he's already dead.